Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. This episode is sponsored, edited, and engineered by my friends at LawPods. LawPods is a professional podcast production company focused solely on attorney podcasting. I absolutely love working with them, and if you're considering becoming a legal podcaster or just want to learn more, check them out at lawpods.com. And now, let's get started. Hello and welcome back. In today's episode, I'm excited to speak with Jason Maida and Natalie Adams, who are currently partners in Foley & Lardner LLP's Tampa, Florida office, where they defend companies and individuals facing government investigation and civil and criminal prosecution. Between the two of them, they've represented clients in a bunch of different industries, including healthcare, defense contracting, procurement, higher education, as well as Title IX complaints and in the financial services industry. Both Jason and Natalie are also former assistant United States attorneys who received a number of accolades and awards for their work on behalf of the United States government. And interestingly, both started their legal careers as judicial law clerks and later as associates at large law firms in Washington, D.C. Jason is a graduate of Harvard Law School, go Crimson, and UC Berkeley, go Bears. And Natalie is a graduate of Northwestern, go Wildcats, the Wash School of Foreign Service at Georgetown, Hoya Saxa, and Duke Law, go Blue Devils. Thank you both for being here. Super excited to have you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, John.
So look, I'd love to start by hearing a little bit about your lives before you became lawyers, or more specifically, what made you decide to join our profession? And because there's two of you, I will occasionally just ask each of you to answer each question and we'll see how it goes. So I'll start with Jason and then we'll go to Natalie.
Hey, Jonah. Yeah, I'd be really happy to answer. And thanks for having me on. It's hard to think back of my life pre being a lawyer, but it was a pretty fun run before that as well. I grew up, Jonah, in a family without any lawyer. I didn't know much about the law. My parents and their parents had immigrated to this country because they were trying to find a country a little bit more just and a little bit more fair than the ones they came from. And they didn't know anything about law. They were both doctors. I thought I wanted to go into computer science. That was my undergraduate major, actually. And I was really excited to be kind of a computer nerd. But it turned out I wasn't that good of a programmer. I tried really hard, but I wasn't that good. And it was really serendipitous, actually, Jonah. I got a two-week internship with a federal judge in Little Rock, Arkansas, of all places. And it was the nicest person I've probably ever met in my life, Judge Richard Arnold. And having the chance to interact with him for 2 weeks made me realize how pervasive the law is, how important the law is, and how important it is to have individuals that want to give back and give to it. I feel really, really lucky to have worked with them, and I'm really, really fortunate to have been a lawyer. So kind of serendipitous how I got into this path.
I love that. And one of the most amazing things that I think we are doing as a profession is recognizing that the pipeline to becoming a lawyer doesn't start your senior year in college, right? It can't start that late or even after college. It's interesting. Something that I know the dean of admissions at my law school where I teach at Georgetown is doing is actually going into high schools so that he can start telling people that they can join this profession and giving people the vision that this might be a good profession for them. So I love the fact that you got that opportunity to work for a judge even before law school as a really great entry point to our profession. And frankly, for any practicing lawyers who are listening to this, I implore you, go out, talk about what it means to be a lawyer, and maybe we'll find some more Jasons in the world. Natalie, how did you end up in our profession?
So I think like Jason, I also didn't always know I was going to be a lawyer. I thought I was going to be a foreign service officer. So I went to Georgetown and I had studied abroad, but I thought I should work abroad before I made that decision. I worked for a nonprofit in Tanzania one summer. And when I looked around, I realized the legal system was so corrupted, and at least where I was working. And the result of that was that no one was safe. No one felt safe. You could buy justice if you were really rich, but your other choice was to do, you know, self-deterrence, right? You just act really violent when people intrude on your rights. And what I thought about that was no one felt safe. No one sort of had the luxury of just acting ethically and going about their lives and protecting their families. And I really valued our legal system after that. And I realized it's really important to acknowledge it, to invest in it, to protect it. And I started applying for law school. So that's how I ended up going to Duke. Never looked back.
Wow. I love it. Yeah. You're not the first guest on the podcast, actually, that thought they were going to be a Foreign Service officer. And it sounds like, again, having that experience and seeing the world really had a huge impact on what you would ultimately do. And we spend so much time in our professional lives. It's nice to do something that we care about and think adds value to the world.
Absolutely.
One of the cool parts about reading your bios, and I'm grateful that Jason actually encouraged me to add Natalie to this, because I think you have both taken similar paths and do similar work today, but also have interesting individual experiences. But for both of you, you started off in big law firms, but fairly quickly ended up in the U.S. Attorney's Office. So I'm hoping that each of you could talk a little bit about your path to becoming prosecutors on behalf of the United States and sort of what you took from those experiences. And I hope we can start with Natalie.
So I never thought I wanted to be a prosecutor. If you had asked me in law school, I would have thought people who want to be prosecutors are yucky. I had no idea that that's where I would go. It was actually someone who told me, hey, if you're somebody who really cares about issues like mass incarceration, overcharging, if you are somebody that really cares about toeing the line, you need to be a prosecutor, not defense attorney, because prosecutors have the discretion of whether to charge, of whom to charge. And a lot of times, certainly in the federal system, a lot of thought and effort goes into that. So by the time a charging decision is made, there isn't that much discretion on the side of defense counsel. And so that really convinced me that, hey, the people that we want on the front lines of that are people who are really thoughtful and compassionate and tempered enforcement, who go after the worst things and who go after it hard and know when it's right to use that discretion. So I didn't expect to be there, but I certainly hope to be in public service. I clerked for a couple of judges, which was an amazing experience. And then I went to Big Law to get trained. I went to Big Law to learn how to be a great writer. I learned how to think strategically. I learned how to research really well. I think Big Law is second to none in teaching people how to research and write in the legal profession. I'm so grateful for that. But then, of course, I want a trial experience. I want to do the fun stuff. I wanted to get into court. And with sort of the idea of that conversation in mind, I applied to some federal prosecutor's offices and I ended up in Tampa, and it's the greatest job in the world.
So I want to push back on that for a second, or at least give you an opportunity to explain, because one of the challenges that I hear from my students who sort of are in the same position that you were of thinking, ooh, I don't want to be a prosecutor. I want to be on the defense side, because they have sort of an aversion to incarceration or thinking that prosecutors are pushing the state in ways that they don't think they should. And I think a lot of prosecutors now say, like, look, I want to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. Did you ever feel like when you were there that you were actually part of the problem? And how did you sort of deal with that reality?
I think I was really lucky to practice in the Middle District of Florida. I had incredible discretion over whether and when to bring cases. I had incredible discretion to reject cases that I did not think were befitting the office, or cases that I did not think had enough evidence, to direct that investigation if it was a worthy case, but it just needed more. And ultimately, if the case wasn't brought all the way to conclusion, to reject it. I think in the Middle District of Florida in particular, and I can't speak to other offices, right? You really do get to pursue what you believe is just. And you have supervision, you have oversight that helps you make sure you don't go off the rails and give you a gut check on your review of evidence and priorities. But I do think that we had incredible autonomy in that office. I know that's not the same in every office. I know that's not the same at every level of prosecution, but I would have been very sensitive to that. And I feel very lucky that I did not feel pressured to pursue a case that was unjust.
And the other thing you mentioned was sort of training, both first in Big Law and then as a United States attorney, assistant United States attorney. Talk to me a little bit about what it was like to go into a United States attorney's office after having worked in Big Law. What were some of the things you felt super ready for? And what were some of the things maybe that you hadn't experienced before and you had to learn on the fly once you left that Big Law position?
So I was ready to research and write on important issues. I was ready to brief, and I was ready to prepare for big hearings. I was ready to prepare for trial. But I had never argued a motion. I had never been to trial. And people have different approaches to teaching. You know, your little kid, you know, swim coach could teach you the technique, the specific strokes, how to perfectly position your body and train you with speed drills. I mean, that's like a big law firm, right? Everything I learned there I learned with incredible levels of supervision and incredible scrutiny. Some people just throw their babies in the pool, right? That is the U.S. Attorney's Office. You are going to learn by doing, and you better learn fast. And so for all the things that I had no experience with, mostly standing on my own 2 feet in court with very little supervision after a while, it's a different way of training and you're not ready for it, but get you ready pretty fast.
I love it. Jason, talk to me a little bit about your path to being a prosecutor, what that was like.
You know, it actually sounds remarkably similar to Natalie's and perhaps Jonah to some of your law students. When I was in law school, I had zero interest in the criminal law. I had an aversion to the whole thing. I think I took one criminal law class my first year, only because I couldn't get out of it. And I didn't take a single other one. I was convinced I wasn't going to do anything on the criminal side. And for the first few years, I did pretty good at avoiding the criminal side altogether. I worked at a large law firm in D.C. I went and I clerked for a judge on the 11th Circuit. I went back to a different law firm. I just couldn't hold down a job for a little while. I went to the State Department. I jumped around a lot. But I really, really wanted to go home, Jonah. I'm from Florida, and the winters in D.C. always got me a little tired. And so when I was looking about how I can get home and how I can do it in a way that was meaningful, in a way that I felt gave back to my state, a job that really stood out was the Justice Department. I was really, really excited about going to a U.S. Attorney's Office. I still had my aversion to the criminal side, though. So I applied, and I was really focused on trying to get a job on the civil side. And I didn't really know what that meant. But I thought it meant a chance to do work for the U.S. government doing civil litigation rather than criminal. And that's where I landed. It was a dream job. I absolutely, absolutely loved it. I missed the job every single day. And I was about to leave the office. I called up the U.S. attorney and I said, hey, I had a great run. Really enjoyed doing civil work for the U.S. government. Thanks so much for the opportunity. I'm about to leave. And he said, Jason, before you leave, I need you to do just a little bit of time on the criminal side. And I wanted to remind him that I was free to leave, but I took him up on the idea of doing it, and I'm thrilled I did it. I loved the criminal work. I loved the civil work. I think it's so wonderful for every lawyer out there to get a chance to see both the civil and the criminal side, because they both bring very unique opportunities and challenges, and they're both very important to our system. That was my journey, Jonah.
So tell me a little bit more about those differences, because a lot of times the challenge of finding your first legal job, and I, again, talk to people all the time about like, what is it that they want to do for their first legal job? And people say, well, ask good questions. People say, read blogs or read guides. Hopefully they're listening to the How I Lawyer podcast, whatever it is. But ultimately, I think it's really hard before you've ever worked on a litigation matter or at least step foot in a courtroom to know the differences between civil practice and criminal practice. And so I guess I would love for you to sort of share a little bit more about what the day-to-day life differences are and sort of what the differences are in terms of how you practice civil law versus criminal law, whether it be at a big law firm or in the U.S. attorney's context.
Sure. I'll give you my perspective on it, Jenna. When I was applying for jobs out of law school, I had no idea there was a difference between civil and criminal. I just didn't know what that meant. I actually still have some of my cover letters that I submitted to law firms, and it's really cringy because I would go to the law firm's website and I would say, I'm interested in all 27 markets that you're in. I'm interested in Des Moines, Los Angeles, and Tampa. And I would say I'm interested in every practice area, real estate, criminal law, everything you got, whatever it is. But I didn't know what any of it meant, right? Hey, and so for me, it was a lot of trial by error. It was trying to figure out what does it mean to do these different areas of the law and then see which ones I liked and which ones I didn't. At a really high level, looking back on it now, having practiced, you know, for 15 or 20 years, for me, civil law takes a lot of different shapes and a lot of different forms. In the end, what it's really about is one litigant and another litigant fighting it out over issues, not always money. I think it's a mistake to say civil stuff is always about money. It's not always about money, but it's private parties that have disputes and can't work it out. And they go to the courts, they go to lawyers to try to resolve it. For me, the criminal side is more about the government trying to make the community safer at a high level. So at a super high level, you know, one side you're talking about individuals fighting it out, on the other side you're talking about the government trying to make the community safer. I think there's a lot of differences and a lot of nuances within civil and within criminal. I think they both bring really unique opportunities. But my real takeaway, having done both of them for a really, really long time, is that whether you're a public defender, whether you're a prosecutor, whether you're a plaintiff's lawyer, whether you're a defense civil lawyer, you really, really need good, qualified, wonderfully talented lawyers on both sides to make the system work. And so I think there's a niche for everyone. And I think just explore them and hopefully you'll find out by trial by fire which one you like the most.
I love it. And before we dive into sort of what you both do today, after you've sort of crossed that aisle representing private clients, one of the common listeners to this podcast are people who are just starting out in their career. And I guess I'm curious if each of you could share either a memory or a skill that you built in either those first few years in big law or as a prosecutor that you now sort of keep with you in your practice today. So Natalie, I'll let you have that one first.
Man, I have a very different memory than I have a skill. My memories are all born from terrible, embarrassing mistakes in court, which you just have at the beginning of your career. So hang on to those.
But you survive, right? That's the amazing part.
You survive, and they're your favorite stories in your career. So when that inevitably happens to us, again, one of your listeners, anyone, I think I would just encourage people to save it, put it in their pocket for later. You'll like telling it later, even if it's the worst thing ever in the moment. But that happens to everybody. The skills I think that I built at the beginning of my career that I keep with me today, that I use today, right? Boy, I remember when I got out of law school, I thought I was a good writer. When I got out of my clerkships, I thought I was a good writer. And then I went to a big law firm and I realized I was not a good writer. I was a bad writer. My briefs would come back just dripping in. I mean, they had been eviscerated. They were bodies, right? I mean, they could not have bled more with red. And at the time, that felt pretty demoralizing. But now it's the thing I'm most grateful for. It's the training that has served me the best, that has lasted the longest, and that has become the most valuable in my entire career. I think writing, the ability to persuade through writing, the ability to explain and tell a story through writing is so incredibly important. And I continue to say, boy, I don't think there's a better job in the world than being a federal prosecutor, but I don't think you can learn to write, at least in our profession, without going to big law. I think it's invaluable and I'm grateful for it. And I love my time at big law generally, but even if I had hated it, I would go back and do it because there's no replacement for that.
Wow. As somebody who teaches writing for a living, I love that perspective. What did you do to sort of take that feedback and actually make yourself a better writer? Because this is another really big challenge that I think a lot of people have is they get those briefs that are dripping in red, as you say, and then they send the next brief in. And frankly, it's equally dripping in red and it's the same kind of issues. What did you do to sort of actually use those experiences, not just as a matter of, oh my God, I don't know how to do this, but to actually become a better writer?
So I really invested in speaking to partners who are great writers and how they thought about writing. And there's a great partner at WilmerHale named Chris Babbitt who would talk about you write the way you read. And I was like, oh, I'm reading Ulysses. That's probably half the problem right there. But he talked about, you know, what he reads. And it sounds so elementary, but devoid in short sentences and how big words don't make you seem smart, right? Being able to break something down simply is what makes you persuasive and effective. I spent a lot of time reading their writing. And at first, I would copy phrases that they would use. I still use some phrases that Chris Babbitt used in, you know, briefs 20 years ago, because I really liked them and I thought that they were effective. But I read their writing. I borrowed some of it. I would copy the style for a lot of it. And then after a while, once you get comfortable with that, I think you start making it your own, right? But it's a process. And I'm sure he would still look at something that I wrote today. I imagine it would come back a little less bloody, but probably still pretty bloody. But I'm so much better for that.
I love it. Jason, what about a skill or memory from your early years in the practice?
I just want to say in my later years of my practice, Natalie still has like passed, has like carried it forward and painted it forward with the bloody drippy red on my writing. So as we're bringing up painful memories, this is all coming to me.
Hey, it.
It continues on in the next of the generation. Hey, you know, Jenna, when I look back at my experience, I had such a wonderful legal career growing up, right? I tried so many different jobs and so many different areas of law, and it was really fun to kind of explore. But when I look back on it all, the lesson that I take away from it is, you know, and it applies to law and it applies to probably anything in life, is you get what you give, right? And you get what you put into things. And I remember when I started out as a first-year associate, You know, every single person that started with me, it seemed like they had won like the Nobel Prize in Law from law school, basically, right? They were all brilliant, like talented, wonderful people. And the ones that really succeeded were those that really passionate, right? Like really gave fully of themselves. And if you give a lot of yourself, you get a lot out of it. And I saw that at every job I had in my career, right? The more you invest in it, the more you get out of it. And so if I were doing it all over again, no matter what job you land with, whether you're graduating from law school in a wonderful economy or a horrible economy, and you get a job you love or you don't love, I would just dive headfirst in and just soak it all up, right? I mean, those early jobs to me are as much training as law school. And just knowing that those early lessons you're going to learn in those formative years of practicing are going to stay with you decades later, that's what I take away from it. And the other thing I'd say is, if you don't love what you're doing, don't be afraid to try something new, right? I had 5 jobs my first 5 years out of law school. And on the 5th one, that's when I found what I really loved, being a prosecutor. So that's why I take away from it.
Do you see any tension there between diving headfirst and also being ready to jump if it's not the right fit, right? I mean, I could see there could be potentially some tension there of feeling like, and especially now with remote work and everything else, like if you give the job everything that's available, it can be a lot. And especially if you don't like it, that can be a real challenge. How, if at all, did you deal with that tension?
Well, I dealt with the tension by jumping jumps. I'm sure there is some tension, right? But I do think there's something to be said for when you're in an experience, you give it all you got and you try really hard, right? If it's something you like, great. And if you learn that you don't like it, move on, right? Life is too short to be stuck with something you don't like. But the only way you're going to know if you're going to really love something is if you're really going to try. And certainly I see some tension, but nonetheless, I would still say, whatever you're doing, give it all you got and see what you can make out of it.
Fantastic. So let's talk a little bit about what you both do today. What would I see if I followed you around? And I know that you're both here because you do a lot of cases together and you work for a lot of the same clients. Talk to me a little bit about what your practice is today. And we can start with Jason and then go to Natalie.
Yeah, I think we have such a fun practice, Jonah. I love it. Natalie and I run this government enforcement little subset group here we got going in Florida. And I really believe, Jonah, that we have some of the most interesting and some of the most complicated and sophisticated work in the state and in the region. And on a good day, I would make an argument in the country. We do probably about 40 to 50% of our work is criminal, and about the other 50 to 60% is civil. It's really varied. There's a lot of breadth. There's a lot of depth. I think both Natalie and I love being in court. We both love to try cases. Earlier this year, we both tried a 4-week jury trial, which was great. Natalie's been trying cases and hearings across the country this year, even apart from that, and as was I last year. I think the one, you know, unifying theme of our work, Jonah, in my mind, is we go after big, complicated, sophisticated problems, whether that's individuals that are being investigated by the government or whether that's large companies that are dealing with whistleblower allegations. So I think it's a really fun practice. It's a really varied practice. And it's a practice that largely interfaces with the government, with us representing clients and defending them from government investigations.
Love that. And Natalie, what would I see you both doing if I followed you around for like a week or a month or even a year? What are those kinds of sort of brass tacks, everyday tasks that you both are doing? And if you have any corrections to what Jason said about your practice, I'll take those as well.
Hey, I think Jason is spot on. I think we practice a lot in the fraud space, but that's both criminal and civil. But in terms of brass tacks, what you're going to see us doing half the day is crisis management, right? When you're on the defense side, and certainly criminally, you're responding to a government action which has the power to totally disrupt someone's life. You are responsive. You don't get to pick the timing of when somebody's arrested. You don't get to pick the timing of when CMS cuts off the money. You don't get to pick the timing of FBI agents showing up at someone's house and turning all their things over and apart, right? So it's being there. It's being ready to react. It's getting ready to talk to the government, to intercede on behalf of your client. And it's telling your client what happens, right? Setting expectations, giving them a road forward and a realistic one and a plan. Here's how we're going to address it. We're going to be proactive. We're going to learn everything there is to know. And we know how this law works. We know it's important. We know where the pressure points are, and we're going to come up with a plan to deal with it, right? But just know, we know how this works and we're in it with you, and here's a plan. The other half of the time is going to be a little bit more quotidian, right? It's going to be the scheduled, hey, I'm going to spend this time making red marks all over Jason's brief. I'm going to spend the time reviewing the docket, talking to co-counsel about a strategy on, you know, responding to these latest discovery negotiations. We're going to be drafting a pleading. We're going to be filing it. We're going to be doing a high-level review of important documents in a case. We're going to be talking to a client about all the tasks to be done to prepare for trial. So it's about half and half. But one thing that I love about our practice is that we are all over the country. We are dealing with clients who have problems everywhere. We are in court a lot. We're standing up. We're arguing motions. We're going to trial. And so we've got a really good mix. It doesn't get boring. And it's always challenging. It's a chance to sharpen your skills and grow your skills and use a bunch of tools. So it's good to have a variety of experiences leading up to practice like this so that you're ready with all your tools when the next thing breaks.
And what are some of the skills that you think make someone in your business stand out? What are some of the either specific types of skills that you need to exercise or even specific techniques or strategies that help you do your job well?
So I can say this about Jason because he won't say it about himself. Jason is incredibly successful in our area of law. And I think that he has three particular qualities that make him exceptional. One is he really practices what he preaches. He dives head first and he goes really hard. We've been catching flights together. It's 4 a.m. at an airport. He's already taking calls from clients. Same at night, right? I'll hear from him at 10:30. Hey, just got off the phone with so-and-so. He is all in for his clients. He's all in on whatever the problem is. If he's got energy in his body, he's using it to solve problems. So that kind of energy and that kind of dedication to clients, I think, are two of the qualities that make him exceptional. The other quality is he has an incredible ability to retain an organized understanding of a lot of different matters at once. We have a meeting once a week early on Tuesday mornings, and you know, Jason will walk through his 65 matters and every task that needs to be done on those matters by heart. He'll even pitch in on some of my matters. He'll say, oh, Natalie, I just think also this other thing, I don't know anything about your case, but I do happen to know these three things, right? So I think that kind of ability to process and retain information, if you're proactive, if you're extremely organized, if you're really energetic, if you love being on the front line, if you're going to be dedicated, you want to be someone's champion, someone's hero, right? That's a Jason Maida. That's somebody that can excel tremendously in this line of work.
Jason, anything to add to that?
Well, that's really nice. I don't know if it's all true, but that's very nice of you to say that. Like, I want to just amend the answer that I'm trying really hard to change our practice so it's not 50% of editing Jason's writing. That is operational. We're trying to get that number down, Jonah. Look, as I think back to like if I was a law student and if I wanted to just kill it in the world of practicing law, either a law firm as a prosecutor, et cetera, and I was thinking of like, how do I do it at a younger age? It's hard to be kind of proactive when you don't know what to be proactive about. Like I can get that. To me, what really distinguishes, Natalie and I work with exceptional people. I mean, there are wonderful people that we work with. But what to me distinguishes the truly spectacular ones from the great ones is they have the love of what they're doing. They have the curiosity to learn more. And they have the fearlessness to try. And I think anyone can do that. I don't think you need to have great intellect to do that, to have love of what you're doing, to ask questions, to figure out what's going on, and to give it a shot. So those are the attributes. And I'll go back to something I said earlier. Maybe I'm just a one-trick pony here, but the more that I see that associates kind of pour into our matters, the more that we, Natalie and I, loop them in. And it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? And so what really helps those succeed kind of in my space, in our space, from my perspective, are those that really are dedicated to trying to be the best that they can be at.
And talk to me a little bit about managing that level of cases, right? So from Natalie's perspective, you're doing this all from heart and keeping track of lots of different deadlines, lots of different tasks, lots of different balls that need to be moved forward, even if someone isn't telling you it's time to move it forward. How do you do that?
Hey, it must be really annoying to have like 65 cases and then have strong opinions about cases where I don't even know anything about. But John, I'll say a couple of things. One, and I really mean this, Natalie's very sweet and very nice to say that, but it's really very much a team effort, right? I mean, it truly, everything in life, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I really believe that. I think what I think Natalie would agree with is the way that I am able to keep up with 65 cases is we have a team with wonderful paralegals and legal assistants and associates that kind of keep us on track. So finding people that you love to work with and having them around you really helps. That's number one. Number two, I really try hard every day, Jonah, to think about what are the 3 to 5 things I want to accomplish that day. And I try to wake up that morning thinking about it. I go to sleep at night and I never accomplish those 3 to 5, but I aspirationally think that's what I'm going to do. And I generally think trying to have a goal is useful. I try to do, for me, I do goals daily, I do them weekly, I do them monthly, and I do them yearly. I never meet any of them, but I try. And so I think just kind of keeping sight of where you want to go with things is helpful. That's what I'd suggest. Natalie, you have different ideas on that?
I think really strong Excel spreadsheet with deadlines and tasks is very helpful. Just organize your stuff, make a chart, and make some accountability.
And this question is for both of you, and you've sort of hinted at it, but I want to get as tactical as humanly possible for people who are sort of junior in our profession. One of the things I've done this past summer, and we're recording sort of in the beginning of August, or getting towards the middle of August, but we won't say that out loud, is go and talk to summer associate classes about some of the skills and best practices that I've learned from talking to over 120 lawyers over the last 2.5 years. And the question that inevitably comes up in these sessions is, everybody says to own the case and be a good worker and be a team player, but how do I show that besides doing good work when you tell me what to do?
I love that.
So I guess it's a hard question for me to answer. I think it's a hard question in general to answer, but I'm curious how you might respond to that. Natalie, you can go first.
Yeah. Hey, I think that's a great question. I think it's so important if you want to be successful as an associate in a law firm in particular. The government, it's all your show anyway. You don't have the option. You just got to do it. But at a law firm, what you should think of is, hey, what does the partner need to do? What are the next 3 things the partner is going to have to do as a result of what we've just learned? Is it they're going to have to calendar something? They're going to have to write an email to the client summarizing what happened? Are they going to have to figure out a way to keep track of what we just agreed to produce on discovery? Right? Let me do that for them. Just send them a draft email to send to the client. If that's what they're going to have to do. You calendar it. If you just had a discovery conference, right? Make a chart of every single discovery request and where you landed on that so that they can keep track of it, right? Don't wait to be invited. And some of this is cultural and some of this is what we've been taught because of our gender or our background, right? To wait to be invited, right? That our opinion needs to be solicited. I would just say, make believe in your mind, there's no one helping you with this case. Imagine that there just is no one else. It just got dropped in your lap. What are all the things you have to do? And then start doing them. And if they're going to take a long time, tell your partner you're going to start doing them so they don't waste their time and do it themselves. And just go. And the more you do that, it's going to have 2 effects. One, the partner is going to tremendously value you, is going to give you more and more opportunity to work with that partner. It's someone you want to work with, so be careful. But the other is, the more you show you could do more of this on your own, the more you're going to have cases where you're running a lot of it on your own. And before you know it, right, you're someone people see as a partner because you're acting like a partner. And that would be my advice.
Jason?
I really agree with that. I'll give you one quick anecdote, which is perhaps so trite, but I think it's trite because it's true, is I think a lot of like younger colleagues that we work with and like how they can show value and ownership when they don't know what the next step is, right? And I think about Uber and taxis. I grew up in DC before there was Uber and the taxis always worked. It was fine, right? I mean, okay, I had a taxi and it was really frustrating to wait 5 minutes or 10 minutes to get my taxi, but whatever, it worked. And then one day someone's like, hey, this Uber app's really cool. Like it anticipated a need that I didn't even know I had. So I read a lot about like Uber and how they came up with the idea and the idea of like, just think of the frustrations in your life and how do you like make those frustrations go away? If I'm a younger associate or a younger lawyer that's just out of law school and I'm trying to show value, show ownership, as you were saying, Jonah, I think, and as Natalie just said, I would think about like, what are the frustrations that I, as a younger lawyer, see? What are the frustrations that I imagine those around me must have? And how can I come up with solutions to solve for them? The best associates that I think Natalie and I work with, they come up with 7 ideas for us and perhaps we take 3 of them. But man, we go to those people every single time over the ones that don't ever propose any solutions, right? So hitting 3 out of 7 is so much better than hitting 0 for 0, right? And I think it gets, you know, I think success breeds success, right? I mean, these things are cyclical, right? The more you do, the more that others are working with you, the more you'll get more opportunities and the more things go, right? One thing leads to another. Hey, I think it just goes over the idea of just try to anticipate, try to own, try to take some initiative on it. You won't always get it right, but at least you're going to be trying hard.
Wow. I love that. I can't wait to share these stories next summer when I'm back out on the speaking circuit. One of the other differences, right, between your old jobs when you represented the government and your new job working in private practice is clients and getting clients more specifically. When you're working in the government, my assumption is most of the time the case comes to you and you both are in a business now where you need to go to the case. So I'm hoping we could talk a little bit about what that transition has been like and also some of the things maybe you've learned about client development and generating business after having been in the government for a period of time. And maybe we can start with Jason and then go to Natalie.
Yeah, of course. Hey, Jonah, as you're going around next summer and talking about these ideas, I think Uber is like really outdated. I think you're going to have to find a new innovation and new idea. So I'll work on it for a year for you. I'll give you some ideas.
Please, or I'll just ask ChatGPT. It'll be fine.
There we go. You're on it. You're right. Client development is really, really different here in private practice than it was in government. You know, in government, you're right, Jonah. A lot of cases came to us. When I was on the civil side, when the government was sued, cool, like I would get a lawsuit that someone else had filed and I dealt with it. Great. But that wasn't always the case in government, right? And I think Natalie can talk a lot about this, as can I. But even in government, you need to go generate your own leads with agents when you want to bring your own cases. You need to be thoughtful about what you want to do. And I'll leave more of that to Natalie to discuss. I'll talk about what it's like in private practice. For me, I left government 5 years ago and I had 0 clients, like not one client to speak of. And I didn't even know where to start, but I called up every single person I knew and I asked them for advice. I just said, hey, what do I do? It was amazing to me how 70% said, I don't know, if you figure out some advice, call me back and let me know what the advice is. But no one knows what they're doing. There's no great blueprint. For me, it was getting out there. It was letting people know I was interested in doing work. It was letting them know what I've done. And it was letting them know just how passionate I was about trying to help. Very oddly, Jonah, my first 4 or 5 clients were people that I had prosecuted that had come back to me. That I think means I was a bad prosecutor, that they had recidivism issues, that they were back at it. But I think what that's also a testament to, I think, is you never know who's going to call you. You never know what type of work's going to come in the door. And so treat everyone respectfully, treat everyone professionally, and treat everyone the way you'd want to be treated yourself. And again, I think success led to success. The more you do good work for one person, the more they think about you for another person, right? That just led to certain things. What has led me to kind of keep clients is this concept we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes of like ownership of like, I tell clients that you're hiring a lawyer and you're outsourcing your struggles. You shouldn't worry about your legal issues anymore. Like leave them to me. That's our job. But that only works if you're actually going to own that. And so it takes investment, it takes time, but it's been fun. I view it as an incredible, incredible trust when clients choose to hire Natalie or I. When they have their most vexing problems and they choose to hire us, it is the greatest trust that they can bestow upon us. And so I love this and I love this type of work, but it's been kind of a bit of a haul. I'd love to hear Natalie's views on this topic.
So I think, yeah, it is a very different way of generating business, right? At the United States Attorney's Office, you just need to be really good, right? You need to be willing to work really, really hard and you need to work hard enough to be good. And agents will bring you cases. Agents will bring you more cases than you can do, right? It's not the same in private practice, right? You don't get to just be a good lawyer. There are concentric circles about what makes a good lawyer and what makes a successful lawyer in private practice, right? Overlapping.
Say more about that.
Yeah. So overlapping skills, right? You need to be good on your feet. You need to be a good researcher and writer. You need to be confident. You need to be willing to sort of put yourself out there in center stage, right? To be good and to be successful, right? You can be a great lawyer researching and writing away. You can be incredibly organized, meticulous. You can be really proactive and work long hours, right? And nobody could ever know about you or have any reason to trust you or have any reason to think of you, right? You're not going to be successful. As a business developing lawyer, you'd be a great associate. You can be a great of counsel. You can be great at a lot of things, but not at developing business. One thing that I see in people who are really successful at developing business that I don't think you need to be a great lawyer, but you absolutely need to be a successful one in this area of law, is people who know everyone, right? People who've spent as much time, right, learning the law as they did building relationships. Because hiring a lawyer, Jason's absolutely right. That is a huge leap of faith on the part of a client. They're going to be spending a lot of money, and they're going to be putting the most stressful, important problem that they have in your hands, right? If they don't know you, if they don't know someone who knows you, it's really hard. It's really hard to trust you. I thought law school was about learning what was in class and doing well on assignments and on tests. And I didn't realize when I was younger that I should have taken as seriously the assignment of getting to know people and building relationships with people. That's a huge part of being a successful lawyer. When Jason and I go to a new city, if we're business developing, Jason does a schedule. We have coffee before breakfast. We have breakfast. We have coffee after breakfast. We have coffee before lunch. We have an early lunch, a late lunch. We have drinks before dinner. We have dinner, and we have sometimes a second dinner and then drinks after dinner with all different people, right? And that's just because Jason knows a ridiculous number of people, and he's really, really faithful to those relationships. I think that is a really big part of why Jason's very successful, and that may or may not make him a good lawyer. He has other skills that make him a good lawyer, but it makes him a very successful one.
Hey, Jonah, actually what it does is it makes it very little time for Natalie to edit my writing.
So oh my God, I've gained so much weight as well. It's like impossible to keep up.
I love it. I love the synergy of two people who clearly work a lot together. And I'm just grateful that you all like let me be an interloper and get to record it for, you know, 45 minutes or an hour in the afternoon. It's been a real pleasure. No, I think those are really great points. And I think it's something that's really hard for law students and for junior lawyers. And confession moment, I left the practice of law before I ever really had to sell myself. And so it's not something that is part of my own personal knowledge base. But as I see my students go out into the world and as I talk to more lawyers, it's amazing to me how much of being a private practice lawyer today is developing both potential clients and actual clients, because without clients, we can't do this work.
Yeah, it's huge.
All right. Well, look, we're getting sort of towards the end of our conversation, and you all have done, you have nailed the brief on advice. And I always end by asking for a piece of advice. But for you, because the two of you are so generous and so fun, I'm going to make it a harder challenge.
No.
I want to end by asking for a piece of advice to somebody who was either just entering the profession, so somebody who just finished taking the bar exam, or even somebody just starting law school, but also some memory or story or something that's happened in your legal career that has changed the way you practice. So one piece of advice and one war story that has changed who you are as a lawyer. And I will start with whoever's willing to start.
Go for it, Jason.
All right. I'm happy to go first. Let me start with a piece of advice, Jonah. The piece of advice that I have is, look, I've talked a lot about, like, you know, you get what you put into life. I've talked about, like, pour yourself into things. I've also talked about, during the last 45 minutes, like, if it's not working, like, it's not working, right? Try something new. Like, don't be afraid. But to me, what unifying about those ideas is perhaps the sentence I just said right there, which is, don't be afraid. What's the worst that's going to happen, right? Just try. You know, throw out 7 ideas, and if 3 work, that's wonderful. Don't be afraid to try new jobs. Don't be afraid to switch jobs. We live in a world where you can jump around so many times. You can do remote jobs. You can do in-person jobs. You can practice as a lawyer. You don't have to practice as a lawyer. Just don't be afraid. It's all going to work out, right? We have a brilliant profession, and we have so many gifts as lawyers. And the more that you're fearless, the better it's going to be. I'm going to tell you about a war story, though, and I'll end on this. I've really loved kind of our niche about really complex fraud cases. White-collar fraud is all I do 95% of my day. When I go home and I talk to my wife, we're talking about white-collar fraud. It's really boring. But that's kind of my bread and butter. And last year, it took me many years to convince Natalie to join me in private practice, but she finally joined me. And she said, I really want to do a trial. And a friend said to Natalie and I, why don't you do a trial for us? And I think both Natalie and I were like, perfect, we're in. No matter what it is, we're going to do. And then he told us what the trial was. The trial was a patent infringement case. And Jonah, I don't think Natalie and I know anything about patent infringement. I didn't even know what the word patent meant. I didn't know what infringement meant. I didn't know what those two words together meant. I didn't know if it was a good thing to have a patent or a bad thing, or whether it was a good thing or a bad thing to infringe it. Hey, it was terrifying, Jonah. We jumped into the case just to do the trial. It had been going on for 7 years. I didn't understand a single word that any of the lawyers were saying, even the ones that were like helping us get up to speed. I remember the lead patent lawyer told us, have this one document, put it out and print it under your pillow and just look at it every night. I looked at it every night. I did not understand it at all. Like, I mean, truly, for 2 months, I looked at it every night and I did not understand the words on this document. I mean, it could have been written in Greek. It probably was written in Greek. Natalie and I did the trial earlier this year. We won on every single count, right? We got a spectacular result. And the result's great. I'm happy for our client. I'm happy. That's wonderful. But what I love about it, Jonah, and the war story part of it, and the part why I end on this is it was something really new, something really different, something that I was really afraid of. And I just said, be fearless, right? I was really, really afraid. Jonah, we walked into court the first day and I had no idea what we were talking about. But it was a wonderful, wonderful experience in retrospect. It stretched, we grew, we learned a lot. And it's what makes the practice of law fun, the idea to stretch and to grow. And so whether you're, 5 days into the practice of law, 5 years in, 15 years in, 30 years in, I would just encourage you to be fearless and try new. That's what makes the profession fun.
Wow. Natalie, with that as the preface.
So just so we can jump in soon, I'd like to say, by the time we walked into court, we absolutely knew what we were doing. Here's part of why we won. So just caveating that. My advice would be, gosh, there are so many people in our profession who are incredible. Jason talked about, meeting all these people who seem to be out of this world. I mean, they've always known what they wanted to do. They've done amazing things before, and they come to the practice of law just ready to run the world, right? Our profession is so crowded with brilliant people, which is very easy. And maybe just for people like me, maybe not for everyone, but I think it's very easy to have imposter syndrome, to feel like you don't belong, like you're not welcome, that you could never measure up to anyone else. My advice would be spend the most time in the rooms with people where you're the dumbest person. Spend the most time in the room where everyone else has a more interesting or exciting story. Spend the most time in the room where you're the one listening and learning, right? Those are the people you want to learn from. Those are the people whose story you want to be a part of. And you can learn so much about how to make your own story from that. Don't take yourself out of the game. Don't take yourself out of a position to compete with anybody or to build with anybody, right? My war story sort of dovetails with that. Man, I remember my summer associate experience at WilmerHale one summer, and never more than that experience had I felt totally out of place, just entirely unworthy. I felt like I was the only one that didn't go to Harvard. I felt like I was the only one who hadn't authored some tome on some philosophical idea. I mean, the people there were unreal. And my office mate, we shared offices then. My office mate was this woman, Harvard Law School, Harvard Law Journal. I think she had a Fulbright scholar, maybe also a Rhodes scholarship. She had a master's in writing. She was incredible. We had the most preeminent appellate lawyers, in my view, in WilmerHale. And they would come to her as a summer associate, come to our office to talk to her and tell her how amazing her work was. And did I mention, I'm sorry, Miss Idaho 2004 also. So if you were confused about whether or not it was intimidating to share a room with her all summer. So that was pretty intense. Years later, I'm getting sworn in to the bar of the Supreme Court. And I'm excited to be there. And they have a beautiful ceremony. And the Chief Justice talks to us. And who do I see in the room but my former Wilmer office mate? And I had this moment where I'm like, you know what? We ended at the same place. You know, we all have our own journey. But, you know, we can arrive at the same kinds of destinations. And, I get sworn in. I know she wasn't sworn in. I was like, oh, that's weird. I wonder why she was here. Oh, she had a really good seat. And so I looked her up afterwards and realized the reason that she was there is because she is our current Solicitor General of the United States. We did not end in the same place. But you know what? I'm very glad that we shared an office. I feel like I learned a lot from her. I learned a lot from the other people in the room. But hey, I think the more that you can be around people who impress you, who scare you, who intimidate you, the better. Go out there and make friends.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you both so much for spending time with me and for agreeing to come on the show. Thank you to one of my listeners, Kyle, who suggested that I speak to Jason and to Natalie, and for Jason for saying, I want to do this, but can I do this with Natalie? I've actually never had that happen in 120 interviews. And I do think it's a testament to how these two people practice law. And despite the fact that I just learned a lot about what they did live as we were chatting, I think you both gave a lot of great advice that applies both in your industry and also more broadly. So I can't thank you enough for being here and for joining me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Jonah, this was so much fun. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much, Jonah. This is awesome.
Awesome. All right. Well, be well. Again, I am Jonah Perlin, and this is the How I Lawyer podcast. Thanks to podcast sponsor Law Pods for their expert editing. If you're a lawyer considering starting your own podcast, definitely check them out at lawpods.com. And thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, I hope you'll consider sharing it with friends and colleagues or on social media. And of course, if you haven't already done so, please sign up for the email list at howilawyer.com or subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. As always, if you have comments, suggestions, or ideas for the show, please reach out to me at howilawyer@gmail.com or at Jonah Perlin on Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and have a great week.